Hello, and welcome to a special episode of a series of podcasts from the agribusiness expert team at IHS Market that focus on the impact of the global coronavirus pandemic across agricultural and food markets. I'm Liz McCarthy, and today, on Thursday, the 9th of April 2020, we are drilling down into detail on one topic. On today's podcast, we have a special focus on the impact of carbon dioxide dislocation on the food supply chain, which is emerging from reduced ethanol production in the face of COVID-19. Tom Scott, our Vice President and Head of Consulting at Agribusiness, will be leading the discussion and is joined by experts from IHS Market Energy and Chemical Divisions. Tom, over to you.
Thank you, Liz, and welcome, everybody. Yes, in our ongoing effort to keep you in the moment and up to date on everything that we see in terms of the impacts of COVID-19, we want to bring to you some thoughts around the supply of CO2 to the food industry. As many of you know, CO2 is used widely in the beverage industry and for frozen fruits and vegetables, and in the meatpacking industry. And where we've been seeing some spot shortages pop up is on the meatpacking side of things. And so we thought we'd delve into that a little bit, find out what the availability and supply-demand picture looks like for CO2, and to try and get some visibility into how big this problem is. To do that, we have some specialists from within IHS Market that we're going to bring to you today. Kevin Lindemir, who's a Vice President of Downstream Consulting. Bala Suresh, who's an Executive Director, Specialty Chemicals and Industrial Gases, and he's our subject matter expert on CO2. Ray Will, who's Director of Consulting, Specialty Chemicals. And Roger Bernard, who is our Policy Specialist within the Agribusiness Intelligence Group. They will all be commenting here today. So, Kevin, let's start out with you. And if you can unpack this issue for us a little bit and kind of scope it out for us.
Thanks, Tom. What I'd like to do is start out first what's causing all of this to happen. And as we know, the economy has been largely shut down, especially in activities that involve gasoline consumption, with more people working at home. A lot of small businesses are shut down. People are not going out. We're expecting gasoline demand in the month of April to be at least 50% lower than it was in April last year. And this could continue into May, depending on the progress of being able to restart the economy and the progress of defeating the virus. So with that, because we have a 10% volume limit, practical limit in place today for ethanol, ethanol demand in the United States must decline by 50% lockstep with gasoline. Second thing is that we do export some ethanol to countries, but all of those countries are also experiencing a similar situation with gasoline demand. So we'd expect exports to go down commensurately and maybe even more, depending if those countries have local ethanol industries. So we're expecting at least a 50% decline in ethanol demand in the United States. Now, what does that mean for from a practical standpoint on CO2? First thing, we've been tracking this a little bit, and we have about 3 to 3.5 billion gallons of ethanol plant shut down as of today. There, in addition, there are several plants that are turning down capacity and continuing to operate at lower rates. One of the issues is there enough storage capacity for the industry to keep running at higher rates? And if so, how long can they go? The most recent estimate of storage was somewhere around 25 to 30 billion barrels or million barrels. Those are 42-gallon barrels. And the actual capacity was up around 41. So we do have some running room on inventory and plants being able to put more into inventory. There are going to be spot shortages because the spare capacity for inventory is not located or logically located with ethanol plants. There will have to be a lot of movement in supply going between operating plants and storage capacity in order to fully utilize it. When we look at the number of plants that have closed, only a handful have associated CO2 recovery, and those are concentrated largely in California. So what we have today is that very few of the plants that have closed actually have CO2 capacity associated with them. We have about 4.3 billion gallons of ethanol capacity that does have CO2 capture and sales. One of the unique character or the characteristics of this is that the ethanol plants do not seem to have CO2 capacity that lines up with how much CO2 they actually produce. Typically, on an industry average, it looks like it's only about 50% of the CO2 in these plants could be captured if you use a 90% utilization rate over the course of the year. So that says we can see quite a bit of turn down in the plants that currently have CO2 extraction capacity, with those plants still being able to supply CO2 into the market. So as of right now, the CO2 issue may be more of one of concern for future supply. There may be some spot shortages, but to us, it looks like we still have some room to go before this could be an issue where there are real structural shortages in CO2 from ethanol plants in the U.S. Back to you, Tom.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. And, you know, that's a deep insight into where the CO2 is coming from the ethanol industry and the dynamics in there that have really set off this issue in the food industry. Bala, can you unpack, just give us kind of the broader picture of this CO2 industry that this ethanol piece is nested within?
Sure. Thanks, Tom. See, carbon dioxide has various applications in gaseous, liquid, and solid states. For example, it's used to produce urea from ammonia in the chemical industry, and it's used as an acidifier in beverage and water treatment, and also as a supercritical solvent like caffeine extraction. In the food industry, it's used as an inerting gas and also as a chilling and cleaning agent. The meat industry uses carbon dioxide as a refrigerant and also as a preservative. And another use that they have is to stun the animals before slaughter. Okay. Liquid carbon dioxide is usually recovered as a gaseous byproduct of industrial operations like hydrogen production by steam reforming of natural gas or like production of ethanol from fermentation. So in some regions, carbon dioxide is also available in naturally occurring deposits. Depending on the source, the purity of the carbon dioxide varies. And in case where there is merchant application, the intensity of purification varies accordingly. The gaseous carbon dioxide is then liquefied for sale as a merchant product because liquid carbon dioxide can be transported more economically than gas. And it reaches end users through a network of cylinder transport, highway tankers, resupply depots, and rail cars. Carbon dioxide is also traded as dry ice in the solid states, and its main use is transport refrigeration. So as a result of all these applications, carbon dioxide can be considered mostly as a regional market. It doesn't travel very far, like more than 200 miles from the point of production. See, after the phasing out of MTBE, when there was a demand for ethanol-based fuel, there were a number of ethanol plants starting up, especially in the Midwest and the Corn Belt. And carbon dioxide is produced as a byproduct from these operations, and supplies have been increasing steadily. Currently, there are around 200 ethanol plants. And according to the Renewable Fuel Association, they say that about 29 of the 45 U.S. plants that sell carbon dioxide have idled or cut rates. And the majority of carbon dioxide from these locations serve the food industry. The food industry is the largest consumer of liquid carbon dioxide. They purchase it in liquid form, but it's used in liquid, gaseous, or solid form. A significant portion is used for chilling to keep the product cool while it's being handled, processed, or transported. For example, like in chilling applications, when it absorbs heat when you're grinding meat or in dough mixing. See, in the past, you have, when you need meat, you go to the supermarket, to the butcher. But now we have packaged meat readily, case-ready packages available in the supermarkets, and carbon dioxide helps to provide that. And carbon dioxide snow is used in the French fry sector, where product is transported over long distances and where it prevents the introduction of moisture into the product. It's also used in beverage carbonation. It imparts a sparkle and inhibits the growth of mold and bacteria, increasing shelf life. Another use is in beer production. Okay, currently, recently there's been a practice to produce a lot of beer concentrates and ship it conveniently to various bottling locations, along with carbon dioxide. In the US, over half of the liquid carbon dioxide is used in the food industry. Beverage carbonation is next, followed by uses in the oil sector. The market volume is close to around about 7.3 million metric tons. That's what I have. Over to you, Tom.
Thank you, Bala. That's great. And Ray, you know, you've had some interactions with the industry actually before the COVID-19, which is, I think, really valuable because it allows us to, you know, kind of where were things, where was the industry coming from pre-COVID-19, and give us some insight on that. So I'll turn it over to you, Ray.
Sure. Thank you, Tom. I think one of the things that's interesting in looking at the CO2 consumption is that a lot of it also was used, as Bala touched on, in oil field. So it's used to pressurize wells to coax more oil out of the ground. And back before we had the crash in oil prices caused from the Saudi Arabia and Russia situation of putting more oil into the market, we had plenty demand going into the oil field area. Well, of course, with the decline in the oil price and less fracking going on, that's freeing up some CO2 in the industrial grade quality. And then going over to the bioethanol, ethanol side of supply, as we rolled into the COVID-19 crisis, we then developed a critical shortage of hand sanitizer, which largely is formulated using ethanol. And so you probably caught consumer issues of not only stockpiling, but also a critical shortage developing from the stockpiling, where distillers and other companies became suppliers into the hand sanitizer market. So while, as Kevin indicated, we have some surplus in ethanol, we also have local disruptions in supply chains. So we have a dislocated market on the supply for ethanol, which provides some of our CO2 supply. And then also we have dislocations and supply disruptions in the CO2, first being registered by the meat packers, mm-hmm. and as Bala and others have indicated, into other parts of industry. So this probably isn't the end. But I guess the good news is there's other ways that we can find more CO2 if this becomes a continuing problem. Existing plants can debottleneck and create more capture of CO2 from their operations. And also we can harness CO2 that's now being emitted to the atmosphere. As you know, CO2, of course, is a global warming gas, the one in majority. And to curtail global warming, it could be important to capture more from fossil fuel burning at power plants, even from composting, where CO2 is released in aerobic digestion. So I see some opportunities for industry to respond. If this is a short-term problem, then we can look at how to improve supply chains and think differently than we had before. If it's a longer or medium to longer term problem, we can look at ways to find more ways to capture CO2 from other processes that currently emit to the atmosphere. So I see some opportunities to respond.
Great, Ray. And, you know, thanks for pointing out the irony of, you know, shortages of CO2, you know, something that's considered a, you know, a global problem. But we actually use it, you know, it's vital to a lot of industries, and good call out on the opportunities. Roger, let's finish up with you, because I think you have some updated information on some changes that might help with some of that debottlenecking that Ray and I think Bala talked about. Roger?
Yeah, Tom, there have been a couple of things, you know, unearthed on this side, you know, of late. The meat industry has been asking that the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service to allow them to use lower grades of carbon dioxide. Now, we're getting indications from some of the meat industry that this is, you know, there is being some allowance made, but there has not yet been one of those formal directives or formal instructions to slaughter facilities relative to using these lower, you know, lower grade levels of carbon dioxide in their operations, in particular on the slaughter runs. So it's ongoing there. So, you know, It certainly seems to be something, as the spate of different actions that we've seen unfold from the U.S. government in the wake of this COVID-19 situation here in the U.S., that if there's a request that is coming through that seems to be reasonable and can be backed up, you know, they're trying to do everything they can from the government perspective to keep these supply chains open and keep them running. Now, to the you know, the point of the ethanol industry's struggles at this stage, both farm state lawmakers and the ethanol industry themselves have made a request of USDA to use what's called the Commodity Credit Corporation. Now, this is an authority that USDA has that they that has a borrowing authority of around $30 billion a year. Under the third COVID aid package, there was another $14 billion of borrowing authority put into this CCC by Congress. Now, prior to that act, they were down to about $7 to $9 billion of borrowing authority left out of that 30. So this, you know, adds some flexibility back in there for USDA. Now, the Commodity Credit Corporation is aimed at taking actions to stabilize, support, and protect farm income and prices. So that's a very broad you know, definition or a very broad guideline for how USDA can use the Commodity Credit Corporation or CCC. This is the trade aid payments that you've heard about going out to farmers over the last couple of years in the U.S. That's the authority USDA used there. What the request has been coming in is relative to helping ethanol plants offset a portion of their feedstock purchases. At least right now, the industry's requested those purchases made during the first quarter of this year, so the January-March period, purchases that they've already made to, you know, supplement those, you know, with some funding from that CCC authority. So that's at least one of the possibilities, I think, that's being, you know, explored. That's potentially a very important thing, especially when it comes to helping out farmers in this situation, in that, you know, some 40% of the U.S. corn crop gets used to make ethanol in this country. So, you know, there's a lot of things that are going on, a lot of things that are being looked at, and would expect that we're going to continue to get a series of announcements from the U.S. government relative to actions to this COVID-19 situation, Tom.
Great. Thanks, Roger. Well, listen, you've heard our experts, and I think you get an idea of the broad range of expertise and knowledge we bring to this. A couple of my takeaways, you know, as Kevin pointed out, there is actually a lot of CO2 still available from the ethanol plants that's either being vented or not captured in food grade quality. So, you know, but as Bala points out, these supply chains are very specific. They're very regional. And, you know, there's some dysfunction there in terms of shifting some of these supply chains. And, you know, Ray, I think, picked up on that very, very well, you know, by saying that, you know, there is debottlenecking that would have to be done. And maybe some of the alternative sources of CO2 can be tapped into. And that would be possible, bringing it back to, I think, Roger's comments. And, you know, the on the policy side, the U.S. government has been very proactive in terms of and being flexible. And I think we're going to see some of the flexibility around this issue, and also maybe some broader help for the ethanol industry that maybe stops the bleeding and maybe slows down at least some of the plant closures that we've been seeing. You know, if anyone has any questions, please contact us. You can reach out to your key account manager or drop us an email. We can certainly take this issue into a lot more depth in a lot of different ways, but I hope this has given you an idea, and more clarity on the market and an idea of what we've been doing in this area. So Liz, back to you then.
Thanks, Tom. And thank you to all our speakers today. As Tom has said, if you would like to get in touch with any questions or comments, or to find out more about the combined benefits of our agribusiness, chemical and energy subscription and consulting services, please email agrisupport@ihsmarket.com or use the contact forms on our website. Alternatively, if you are an existing client, please reach out to your account manager. Thank you for listening.